In the 1960s, Jamal Joseph told students at Columbia University to burn their college to the ground. Today, he's chair of the film division at the University School of the Arts. In his book, Panther Baby, Mr. Joseph describes joining the Black Panthers when he was just 15 years old, his fast rise to a leadership position in that organization, and then his incarcerations at Rikers Island and Leavenworth Prison. The book is published by Algonquin Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Jamal Joseph to our show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Now, it's ironic that you've called your book Panther Baby because you were enraged when you were called Panther Baby the first time you were jailed in Rikers Island.
Yeah, that title is kind of has a double meaning because I was the baby of the organization, and you get that mentorship and that same, you know, treatment as the young one. But in fact, the real turn is that when it was used in Rikers Island, when a prisoner was trying to set me up to be raped, I was enraged and, you know, had to fight back.
That was Lefty, and you did fight back. You got 20 days in a segregated unit for fighting because you'd broken his nose with a tray. But, of course, that turned out to be worth it, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Got respect?
Well, first it was coming in, you know, being a political person, not wanting to fight other prisoners, and you're thrown into this culture, this prison culture where – you know, people are extorting, people are fighting, people are doing this. And so, you know, I tried to organize through speeches and passing books. And then at a certain point, you have to become part of the battle, part of the fight in order to create a space where people could come together and organize. And
now, this was 69. You were 16 years old. And
I just turned 16 years old.
You've been rounded up in jail with 20 other members of the group's New York City leadership. What were you charged with?
We were charged with conspiracy case, and it was conspiracy to plant bombs at department stores during the Easter shopping season, botanical gardens because, of course, the Panthers were opposed to flowers, according to the district attorney. And the idea of the Panther 21 case was that you'd round up everybody in a leadership position, cut off the head, and the body will die. And so though I had joined at 15, I had become – head of the youth cadres, and I was part of that Panther 21 case. That case was made by the district attorney's office and two people who were part of an elite police unit called the Boss Unit, the Bureau of Special Services. One person, Gene Roberts, had been Malcolm X's bodyguard from the Nation of Islam and the Organization of African American Unity Days. And the other person had been my mentor when I first joined the Panther Party. It taught me the 10-point program, made sure that I showed up at the breakfast program and all the community activities, and even convinced my grandmother to let me come back into the organization. And we found out that he was an undercover cop. So that was betrayal not only to the organization but on a personal level as someone who was had been orphaned, who didn't know a father, and had looked at this person as a role model.
But was there any truth to the accusations?
Well, no, there was no truth to the accusations. What was true is that there was some military training that went on in the Panthers, and so that we got out, we jogged, we exercises, and you know, went to, you know, to the woods and did some target practice. But that the most of your work in the Panther Party, 95% of your work, was stuff like the breakfast program, organizing, in welfare centers, health clinics, liberation schools.
So you learned how to make pancakes and stuff like that.
Well, the first thing that happened to me when I walked into the Panther office, it was right after Dr. King was killed. I came in enraged, knowing that I wanted to be a black militant, not even sure what the term meant. I thought that meant you're mad at white people. And
even though Dr. King preached nonviolence?
Well, when Dr. King was killed, kids who were on the verge of being radical became radicalized because to us that meant it didn't work. To us that meant that the racist government would repay love with hate and that they would attack. So I came in the Panther office ready to fight, ready to kill a white guy if I had to. And I said that in a meeting in the middle of the 10-point program that has nothing about killing white people or cops or anything. And they called me up to the front. And the brother very ceremoniously opened the bottom drawer and reached slowly in. And I thought, oh, here comes my gun, and I'm scared. And he hands me a stack of books. Soul and Ice by Eldridge Cleaver, Autobiography of Malcolm X, Frantz Fanon. And I think this must be a test. And I said, excuse me, brother, you said you were going to arm me. And he said, young brother, I just did. And then he disabused me of the notion this was about hating white people. He said, look, if the cops, if the storekeepers who rip people off in the community, if the cops who are beating people up, if the government, if everybody was black and everybody being exploited and oppressed was white, would that make things correct? And I said, no, that seems like it would still be wrong. He said, that's right. This is class struggle. This is liberation for all people. Study those books so you understand what the, what this revolution is about.
So even though your life has taken a very different turn, you still believe a lot of what you were getting at that time?
Well, yes.
The because Panthers also were associated with violence, at least the West Coast Panthers.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I want to just come back to the Panther 21 case just for a moment. That case was almost 2 years in progress. The trial itself was 9 months. And all of these conspiracy charges and attempted murder charges and weapons possession charges, we were facing over 300 years. You know, this is the kind of sentence you have to be reincarnated a couple of times to finish. Right?
William Kunstler was the first lawyer you spoke to.
William Kunstler was the first lawyer.
Did you even know who he was?
I didn't even know who Bill Kunstler was. I came in and this white guy with a very strong grip said, hey, brother, power to the people. There was a whirlwind. You know, cops had kicked in my grandmother's door, drugged me downtown at 5 in the morning. And then Gerald Lefcourt became lead attorney, and Fani Shakur, who was a defendant on the case, represented herself, Setchaway Tabor. But this case that went on, and that our bail was set at $100,000, which was a ransom, we were acquitted.
Well, let's stop with that for just a second. How did that compare to the bail for other people who were called militants at the time?
Well, for other people who were considered, so for example, there had been some white students who were arrested in a bomb conspiracy case, and their bail was set at $5,000 and $10,000. And these were upper middle class kids whose families could easily afford that. $100,000 is a lot of money still today. Imagine what that was like in 1969 for people.
So it was designed to keep you in prison.
It was designed to keep you in prison. It was designed not to give. The whole atmosphere was designed not to let us have a fair trial and to railroad us. And we turned the trial into a political arena. We talked about racism, oppression, slavery, the tactics of the FBI, the murder of Dr. King, the murder of Malcolm X. And the judge was trying to rein us in and, you know, try to focus on what he thought were the core issues. There were some weapons that were recovered in the morning of the arrest, because the Panthers did say, you know, that you should have weapons for the purpose of self-defense. There had been Panther officers that had been raided, Panthers who were killed. The judge dismissed the gun charges at the end of the trial because he wanted people to focus. He thought there had been too much political rhetoric, gave the case to the jury, instructed them what they could find us guilty of, and the jury came back in 3 hours and found the Panther 21 guilty on all counts. And when they interviewed him later and they said, how did you reach a verdict so quickly? I said, well, once the judge dismissed the weapons case, there was nothing else.
So you were out?
I had already been out. I was severed from the case as a youthful offender.
You said guilty. You meant not guilty.
Not guilty. I'm sorry. The Panther 21 is found not guilty on all charges. Let's make that very clear. Acquitted on all charges.
You never knew much about your father except that he was Cuban. But didn't you learn much later that he'd fought with Che Guevara? Do you think that being a revolutionary was in the genes?
Well, my grandmother certainly thought so. I was in prison. I was in Leavenworth. And my grandmother came to see me with an aunt, her sister, who had come from Cuba. And they looked at me and they were in tears and they were saying, pero hijo, this is not your fault. You're such a good boy. We know you're a sweet boy. It's your father. He fought with Fidel. He fought with Che. And I had never heard stories about him before. I found out that he did fight and became Cuba's ambassador to Tanzania. And I was overcome with emotion. And I said, well, auntie, grandma, I really appreciate all this information about my father. I never knew this. I'm not quite sure my politics are a genetic disorder, though.
Well, you were an excellent student, skipped the eighth grade, were only 15 years old when you were in high school. And you had originally planned to go to law school when you were in your teens. And here you are growing up in the Bronx, living with people, foster parents, who were obviously loving you, called them your grandparents, and then you present yourself at the Black Panther office and say, I'm ready to fight. So you were throwing everything away.
Yeah, I think there were some core values, though, that I didn't throw away, because my grandparents, my adopted grandparents, had been born in the 1800s, in the late 1800s, and their parents had been slaves. So I heard stories about the South and segregation and lynching and the Ku Klux Klan firsthand. they had been part of the Garvey movement, and they were part of the NAACP. So we had these values that we that were at the dinner table and at our church about social justice. Grandma, who was still alive when I joined the Panthers, certainly wasn't very, very happy that I was so radical. But then as she, you know, as time went on and she understood the service component of the Black Panther Party and my commitment, I think understood.
Even though you were found not guilty, you didn't feel safe in New York. Why not?
Well, Fred Hampton had been murdered in Chicago. Panthers were being arrested every day. Panthers were being killed. So we felt that we weren't going, and we also felt that we would get life for hundreds of years, and we didn't voluntarily want to walk back in prison. So there was a decision to go underground and become part of this revolutionary underground movement.
You even considered fleeing to Algeria?
Did, and got as far as across the Canadian border, and then wanted to come back and just fight the fight in New York. And that fight for me was this drug epidemic that was going on. And you know, Harlem at that time, you go to Harlem today and it's so beautiful with the brownstones that have been renovated and new condominiums. But there were blocks and blocks that looked like a bombing raid had happened after World War II, and where junkies were lined up buying drugs, where people, teenagers, were ODing in the streets. And we aggressively started taking the drugs out of Harlem with guns.
Although you separated yourself from the rest of the Black Panther movement, changed your name. You describe being arrested again in 1981, charged with harboring fugitives and being who were wanted by the FBI. 12 and a half years for that?
Well, when you assist someone who's on the run, even though you are not charged with the main crime or acquitted of the main crime, you get half of what they're facing.
That's like going along on a robbery where somebody's killed and they bring you up on murder charges as well.
No, well, this is not even going – what I was convicted of is not even being convicted of going along on the robbery. This is an accessory after the fact. So this is if somebody was to show up, you know, at your door saying, you know, I'm on the run, I'm in trouble, and you give them some shelter. And then, you know, especially if you take the extra step in helping them get out the state or out the country, you get half of what they're facing.
No, it's terrible that you went to prison again, but in an odd way, it led to your current situation.
It absolutely did. I got great advice when I first got to Leavenworth from an older convict who said, young blood, you can serve this here time, or you can let this here time serve you. And it was great. So I took advantage. I enrolled in the college courses. The University of Kansas had a great program there. Guys found out that I had done a little theater and challenged me to write a play, which originally was going to be a Black History Month play. And then some of the Latino prisoners showed up. We thought it was going to be a gang war. And one guy said, yo, Holmes, that guy you're working with is not feeling his character. So I rewrote the play and put him in, and he was great. And then the white guys showed up because they were worried about what the blacks and Mexicans was doing. And they came back to the other guys, and they said, what are they doing up there? And they said, a play. And they said, well, what did you do about it, Reb? Because this guy was a one-man wrecking crew, black belt, 6'3", 220 pounds of muscle. They said, well, they give me a part. And so before you know it, we had taken what was a segregated main yard in prison where guys stood according to race and, you know, those beliefs, and had our own section where guys were doing theater and college and this multicultural kind of classless thing that we were doing.
Although later you realized that you suffered from PTSD as a result of this. It's always rough if you're in prison for a long time. But you came out and wound up being able to use your education to the point where you're now at Columbia?
I'm at Columbia, and as you mentioned, served as chair. I'm actually on sabbatical now, so that wonderful job is passed on to someone else. Ira Deutschman is the current chair of the film program, but served as chair for 5 years. And what I learned in prison was that arts and education would be the new weapons for social change. Bobby Seale said the Panthers carried shotguns and law books because those were the dynamic of weapons of social change at that time to deal with police brutality. But that if the Panthers were starting the day, and I totally agree with this, Panthers would be on the street, but with video cameras and laptop computers.
Jamal Joseph will be going back to Columbia to speak at Columbia University's Miller Theater on Friday the 17th at 6:30. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. On Monday the 27th at 7:30, he'll be at Greenlight Bookstore in Fulton Street in Brooklyn. His book, Panther Baby, A Life of Rebellion and Reinvention, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.